I'll let you take over.
Great. Thank you so much, Don. And I just want to thank all of you for the opportunity to be here today. Spreading the word about parenting, especially with our clients in dependency world, is something that's so near and dear to my heart. Let's just start off with kind of the idea about what we mean by evidence-based parenting. I know a few years ago when I was at the summit, the dependency summit in Orlando, probably 4 or 5 years ago, that was the hot topic that was beginning. Judge Gooding, our judge in this circuit, put together a task force, which myself and another person chaired, and we really had a year that we had to just delve into what does this mean. Well, where Judge Gooding was really helpful is he had sent us actually, in his mind, the directive that he wanted us to follow, and that would be in your PowerPoint, actually the very first page. And this was from a directive that they had received, the judges, about what they should look for. It may have been from a bench book, to be honest. I can't remember. I don't have that in front of me right now. But if you look at it, what it was really reassuring to me, just from a pragmatic point of view, is that it's supposed to be a selection of program services that can be based on many factors, including appropriateness for the population served, community needs, and agency capacity to implement services with fidelity, which really means personnel and money. States will need to carefully assess their local needs and the range of different evidence-informed and evidence-based programs they will need to fund to meet these diverse needs. Now, that's you attorneys, I'm sure, can understand that because attorneys are used to legalese all the time. But just to kind of get it basic, what that means is that those of us that do this and those of you in this business, you say, wow, I have a parent who's got an infant. She's got a 10-year-old. She's got a 12-year-old. How can one parenting session or one program in 12 sessions serve all of that? So parenting, when people hear it, is, as our judge likes to say and others, you know, a tree can get a parenting certificate. For many years, the model was that we did nothing but group classes. And to be totally honest with you, what sometimes I worry is that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because just like in a substance abuse model, you have individual work with a client, but you also have group work where they're around other folks who they hear that they're in the same boat. They get support, peer support. They also get accountability in that group. But having said that, even though we still do groups, primarily in our circuit and across the state, they're really encouraging one-on-one parenting. I actually asked a dad yesterday who's been through 2 sets of our groups in the last 8 years, and he's been doing one-on-one with me with Circle Security, and I said, give me your opinion. I really want to know. And he said, well, you know, those groups are okay, but, you know, they're fine. But, you know, I've been through that before. And this is a man you have to understand who's very, shall we say, he lacks not for any self-esteem, shall we say. So he said, but I like it. Now, keep in mind, he has a super long trauma history, and his adverse childhood experiences score is like an 8. So it took a lot of work in the Circle Security sessions, which I finished with him yesterday, to really get to that trauma, which that you're not going to get in a group. So having said that, what I like about this is as we pursued in our circuit what is evidence-based parenting, we took all of this into account. All right, so let's look at our next types of parenting programs that Children's Home Society provides. All right, they include lecture, discussion, video, one-on-one observation. Nurturing parenting, that was kind of that's evidence-based. It's one the state of Florida for a while insisted we use. Now they've kind of DCF when we were not privatized. Now what's happened is, as long as we can demonstrate that it's evidence-based, and many of you attorneys, and I know the CLS attorneys and the parents' attorneys will say, is this evidence-based that you've been doing? So nurturing is still, it's a good one, but I will tell you that we have one county, I work with all 5 counties in our area. We have other providers that do it too, which is great. You know, like you have a lot of attorneys, you can have a lot of parent educators. But one of the other counties, they brought me in to consult on a case that is just complex and not seem to be going anywhere. And I said, well, in the nurturing program, does this parent educator use the videos? Well, no, they don't ever use videos. Well, that's not using it. It's meant to be used. We have a huge part of our population that are either not sober, illiterate, they have a lot of issues that really impact that their listening comprehension is not great. Videos are the next best way because these videos are interactive. So if you have someone in your community using a nurturing program, I really would recommend you ask, tell, are you doing it with Fidelity? Are you using the videos? How is this done? Okay. 1-2-3 Magic is almost too easy. You can see it on YouTube. It is evidence-based. It's kind of, I like to tell clients, it's like what my grandmother used to say when we were little, I want you to go out and pick in the vegetable garden. She lived in Alabama in the country. And we'd say, we don't want to. She'd say, I'm going to count to three, and you better do what I say, or we're not going into town to get ice cream this afternoon. Parents understand that kind of lingo. It's a very simple program, and it's very easy to assess if a parent's doing it. All right. Partners for a Healthy Baby is for the first three, it's prenatal, but it's the first 3 years of life. It is from Florida State, and I'm not biasing there. That actually was put together without me saying, let's get the FSU curriculum. We use it in Early Head Start. We also now are using it in our other programs. In fact, they have one of the best, the recent curriculum update has the Adverse Childhood Experiences score, which have been used in actually TPR proceedings, and our judge has admitted, and the attorneys have allowed it to be admitted, that if a parent has a certain ACEs score and by a certain point in the case plan they have not made measurable behavioral progress, then what is the likelihood that that's going to happen? Now, you attorneys understand the legalese about that under Chapter 39 and reasonable efforts, et cetera, but, and maybe despite efforts, Christine can weigh in on that, irrespective, mm-hmm. I believe it's called. So Partners for Healthy Baby has some really very user-friendly, and it's for the first 3 years. Reality Baby, now I think I'm going to proud to say we are probably the only circuit that uses that. It's an amazing teaching tool on two levels. Some of you are young enough that you maybe in high school had, you know, the baby they'd let you take home and it would cry and you'd have to see what was wrong. Well, that's basically, it's called Reality Baby, Real Care Baby. We have two ways we use it. One is we literally can do this with a parent who has a new baby. We did it recently on one who has a shaken baby, and the father was the one that did the shaken baby. The mother was in the home. So we did it, and the mother had to have the baby for 2 days. And the updated version we had just gotten, it even measures whether or not you're keeping the child in the right temperature. In other words, it helps to know if you're keeping the baby in the car where it's too hot. Mm-hmm. And we just had winter in Jacksonville, and we were able to show on one mother that she kept the baby in the cold. We're also, with that one, able to see, did you put the baby in the car seat during this time? It's really cool. Okay, so that's one, and then we get a computer printout that gets dispensed to the attorneys, to the department, to the CNOs, and it really can say, wow, you know, and to be honest with you, it can work both ways. I think it's going to be down the road, probably, it's like lie detector tests. I think if somebody really challenged it, it would probably be, was this really admissible in court? But so far, it's been something that's been a useful tool just in our toolkit of assessments. The other way we use Reality Baby is that we have what we call our mannequin dolls. What that is we have three dolls that are demo dolls. One is a shaken baby. We literally show a parent, we turn the baby on, the baby starts screaming. And the baby has a clear skull that shows the brain. And when that baby gets shaken, the brain lights up.
Wow.
And I can tell you the impact of this happening. I've done it to nurses. I do it all, and they go, oh, my gosh. And what's really very impactful is who are they going to argue with? They're going to argue with me about, no, I can shake my baby if I want. No, they're going to see that this is what happens. And they also see, in all fairness, how little shaking it takes. That's mm-hmm. what I think has been tough for us. We also have a fetal alcohol demo doll where that shows just the tragedy, really, and what happens with children who have full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome. And then the last one is the substance-exposed baby. Because what you'll get sometimes with parents is they'll say, well, my baby was fine. But what they don't understand is they maybe didn't see the baby in the hospital. They did not see the withdrawal these babies go through. This baby, literally, you turn it on, and it starts shaking and screaming. So there, and I have to tell you, there are times when I get parents who, especially dads, I'm not being gender specific here, but sometimes dads who've never been around children might say, oh, that's no big deal, I can handle it. Well, what I do is I turn that baby on and the baby keeps screaming and screaming and screaming. And I said, do you see, this is in anger management, because a lot of them have anger management issues. This is what we got to work on. You know, how are you going to get calmed down when this baby is doing this? Because the baby will. That's what babies do. All right. So that's the reality. I'm going fast, and we're going to have time for questions, so please just take note of any you want to ask. The next is, many of you are very familiar with Circle of Security. That is the current, that and adverse childhood experiences are kind of the current new kids on the block in terms of evidence-based and what can we really use to determine change of behavior. Because in your world, you're all about manifest best interests of the child. That's what you guys, and that's what I respect so much. You totally focus on that. I'm gearing all this to this population I'm talking to this morning. Circle Security is based on the idea, and if you look at your next slide, it will show you just basically what we teach parents. And I adore this program. You have to be certified to do it. We have two at Children's Home Society that are certified, and I think in Duval County we maybe have six or seven. But I will tell you, the thing about Circle Security is that, my opinion is, in order to teach this, really have to have a good deal of experience with children and be able to kind of put it in context what the parent themselves are going through. So what I love about this is if you look at the bottom right on your slide, the premise, and Chris Green is sitting here, and I've been in trial with him before, and he's probably heard me say this when I've testified, the parent always should be bigger, stronger, wiser, and kind. And I'll say to parents, is that something you agree with? Oh, yeah, I agree with that, yeah. Whenever possible, you follow children's needs. But whenever necessary, you have to take charge. Now, the antithesis of that, and boy, when I go to the jail and work with these folks who are substance abuse and just have lots of issues that way, maybe domestic violence, the other thing about that you cannot be as a parent or should not be, there's three things, mean, weak, and gone. And substance abuse, that is absolute tragedy, is that you should not, you can be the best parent in the world, but if you're gone, and if you're weak, and you don't protect your child, then you're not going to be able to have that protective capacity. Mm-hmm. And many times, like I said, you know, when they'll ask me, I get cross-examined on the stand by a parent attorney, I'll say, well, the dilemma is this parent, you know, in Circle Security, and they're not going to argue, because that's evidence-based, and this is what we use, and everybody in our circuit agrees. In my opinion, we're now at permanency in 9 months, and bless their hearts, they're still weak. They keep going back to the father, or they're doing this, or they're doing that. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means they can't do it. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's the Circle Security. And the other two are active parenting, which are three age levels. That's video-based, too. And then we have here the Early Head Start home-based program. Now, that's an interesting, let me back up. Healthy families, many of you know about. Healthy Start, you know about. Healthy families is child abuse prevention. Healthy Start wants the baby to get here healthy. Early Head Start home-based program, we are utilized in our circuit for these parents who we are closing out to court cases, or the parents are pregnant and they have children. Because what happens is that they can go into the home free of charge, and they basically implement a lot of these curriculums. And what we have found has been very useful. We had a real success case where a mother became pregnant. It was a DV situation. And we got an Early Head Start home-based visitor in there for the pregnancy. And not only did she help deliver that baby in a healthy way, but she, because of the way this program is set up for the domains, she addressed the other needs of the mother and was able really to work closely with the CBC, and that the children will return. And they still are. They're still doing really, really well. So that's just an example of kind of the tools that we have. Now, you may say the next one is, how do we know if the parents have learned and can apply? If I had a nickel for every time I had that question, I really could go on an autism pay trip to Tahiti probably. All right. And as I said, I don't have a crystal ball, and my magic wand is broken. But this is the situation. We do a pre- and post-assessment. Now, ours is a little different. Some of you may be familiar in the clinical world with something called biopsychosocial. In Early Head Start, we call it a parenting needs assessment. But basically what it does is it addresses all the stress, all the domains of a parent's life that affect their parenting. So, for instance, if I have a back that is going out constantly and a lot of pain, which of course may mean they're on pain pills, but if that's affecting me, then I need that. That may affect my parenting. It's kind of like the old bear with a sore paw and they're in a bad mood. The more stressors parents have, the less they're able to be bigger, stronger, wiser, and kind, like we say in Circle Security. So we do a parenting needs assessment. It's a narrative assessment. It's probably 5 pages long. We also, in that, it's like a little CBHA in a sense, but it's really now focusing more on where is the parent now, how can we use that information, and then decide which of these parenting programs are needed. Mm-hmm. Now, we also will say we feel like based on not just our assessment, but information we have from the CBHA and from the FFA, that this parent, we need to make sure they get therapy. Now, also have to be clear that we're a team, even though we may not always agree. So, for instance, if I know in my expertise, you know, I really think, like, we really need to get extra testing on this or extra testing on that. Chris Garino here and I have a client here where the mother was born deaf, it turns out. Well, I just went ahead and took it upon myself to get with the case manager yesterday because she's had hearing aids, but she's the one with a shaken baby. Well, now she has another baby. So that's really what our issue hugely is this new baby safe in her home? Well, I suspected she was not hearing very well, but she denied that. Well, we brought her dad in. She's just 18. She's just turned 18, and was 15 when she got married. So she came in, and indeed, this poor young woman, he said, I don't think my daughter probably even hears most of what you say. And I said, well, the problem is she's an adult, and when we said to her, do you need help, she said no. So what I have said, and thank God for you guardians, literally, you're amazing, because the guardian ad litem that was sitting there, he's a volunteer, but it's just a retired principal of special education, I said, I want a comprehensive speech and language evaluation done on this mom. Not just because the mom, and thank heaven, and I got the guardian on my side, you know, Judge Gooding's going to say, really? You guys are going to argue with Mrs. Clark and the guardian, you know? So what's cool about it is we're going to have that has to do with me having a background agency for persons with disabilities and speech and language, and I consulted with a speech and language pathologist I know, and I started describing behaviors. Now, this is a long-winded way of me saying assessments, they're fine, the paper assessments, but to be honest with you, and you know this already because you work with different parenting and different service providers, it's an art as much as it is a science. You've got to have critical thinking skills. You've got to be willing to put the time and the effort and the work into it. So we do some simple things, though. The nurturing quiz. It's a 20-question yes or no about basic discipline. And what we find many times, and I think I addressed this in another part of the PowerPoint, is so many times with these parents, it's not knowing what to do. We can get them there. And many times they're almost halfway there. But it's doing what they know. So that's where the ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, and I'm assuming that most of you know about that. If you don't, read up on it because it's coming. Mm-hmm. It's there. What we have found with the Adverse Childhood Experiences score, 10 of them, is that trauma absolutely stunts that developing brain. And when I say that, we know that about the kids you guys represent. But what I'm telling you from the parents, and this is why I won't say I never lose sympathy, but at my core, my very core, I know that these parents that we get so frustrated with were babies. And I've lived so long now, unfortunately I'm having repeat customers, that the babies I had as a social worker are now grown-ups. Mm. You know, I had a man in the jail the other day. I went, gosh, your name sounds familiar. And we talked, and it turned out he was a child I'd had in the group home about 15 years ago. And the dilemma is I know his history of trauma. So all the stuff that you guys are getting educated about trauma, it is true. We're knowing now with the ACEs that more and more of our parents, not just the mental health, it's the physical health. Obesity, cancer, pulmonary issues. I mean, I had seen over the years how ill a lot of these folks were at young ages. Mm-hmm. Well, what we know now, thanks to the Kaiser Permanente and CDC study in the late 90s, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, is, wow, this is really something. This is affecting people. Mm-hmm. So the problem that we see with our parents, and I'm just being honest, as an adult educator, this which is what I am, is that they just have a hard time because of all that trauma brain, even if they're doing well right now, they really have a hard time sometimes applying it consistently. And what I have to remind, you know, I sometimes get case managers, guardians, or others, they get real impatient with mothers because, oh, they're backsliding, they're relapsing. I said, look, this one mom we have right now, I said, you know, this is the deal. She's never lived by herself before. She's had her daughter was sexually abused twice. She has gotten out of that relationship. And you know what? She's never lived alone. She's got a full-time job. But, yeah, she's going to have some emotional relapses. Well, guess what? You know, she was raped twice, as we know, as a child. Her mother abandoned her. So we're not going to turn this around in a year. Okay. So the bottom line is we look at those. The ASQ is Ages and Stages Questionnaire. Y'all should know if the CDHA is supposed to do that, please look at that. And as guardians, what you really can also look at is you have this for a year. Many times the CDHA in the fine print says this needs to be evaluated. So you go to early steps, maybe. Early steps says, well, they're not quite eligible, but guess, you know, come back and see us in 6 months. Well, what I see oftentimes, that just goes by the wayside. Because you really, a lot of these kids do a lot better after a few months in a stable environment. But then the other piece of it is sometimes they go further downhill, and that's cause for concern because now they're in a stable environment. So we look at the, I said, parenting style, domestic violence, substance abuse, mental health, cognitive impairment. Cognitive impairment is a huge one. And I will tell you the bad news is I have yet to find someone. If anybody on this call knows some recent research, within the last 6 months I've checked again. There's no evidence-based parenting curriculum or strategies for people with intellectual impairments that really has been shown to demonstrate well. Now, we can use the same, what I do and train my staff to do is we do the same idea that you would do with someone who's in a special education classroom for that IQ. It has to be concrete. We have to see if they can transfer some of the principles from concrete from abstract to concrete. So if a mother can say to me on a piece of paper that looks like a coloring book, she can circle the pictures on the living room of what's dangerous to a baby, that's great. But it's not uncommon for me to go into her home and she can't do it right there. Or she may know that, yeah, okay, Ms. Marty told me not to burn a candle in my apartment, no, not to smoke in my apartment, no, burn a candle with the children there because it could burn down. So what she does is I found her the next time, she's downstairs smoking because it's heat and it's fire, and I told her not to be around the children with fire, but she left the children alone. So that's the kind of stuff that it's really hard. You don't fix that, to be honest. You don't fix it. So we look at all that. Teaching modes at the bottom of that group, one-on-one. Coaching during visitation. Okay. Now, we do a combination. We kind of like have, and this is where I said before I retire or get old or die or whatever, I got to get the recipe. People will say, what's the recipe here? And I said, the problem, I'm like on Grandma with biscuits, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But this has made me do this when I did this first with the gals last year, put it kind of as a recipe. You have to constantly reassess the group, like the lady I talked about, the speech and language. It's just been till now that we've been able to get to that point where we can see we've got to do more. Because if they're going to get TPR on this baby, we have to demonstrate that that's going to be the case. And this is another example. In visitation, which we'll get to in just a few minutes, in this case, this baby, the second baby, has 18 physical therapy exercises that are supposed to be conducted twice a week while she's visiting. I had her sign a piece of paper. She was showed by the physical therapist, medical foster parent. She signed that she would do it. Now, do I think she did those 3 months we took data? I made the visitation monitors. Every single visitation, I want her monitored. Now, you can prompt her the first two or three times, but after that, we just got to see if she remembers it. And unfortunately, over a three-month period, the best she ever did was 5%. Maybe there was like 4 zeros and a few 2 or 3%. Now, her rationale is because she just wants to cuddle her babies. And her father even said to me, it's just so unfair. Why do you call it visitation? She just wants to spend quality time with her child. That was a real wake-up call for me. And to be honest, that's the first I'd ever I mean, I knew people looked at things in different lenses, but her father was really, he was not disrespectful to me. He just said, I don't understand this. This is so hard on her. And I said, I know it's hard on her, and I am so sorry. But, and we'll get to this in a minute with visitation, this is the comeback you have. Best practice for visitation, first and foremost, is that the child's developmental needs are met. Let's just say that again. First and foremost, the child's developmental needs have to be met. This, and I said to the father, and I said it as kindly as I could, sir, this, your daughter is your child, and I respect that. But the dilemma we have in visitation is we are supposed to meet your grandson's needs first. And his needs are, we've got to see if his mama can do physical therapy on him. So he kind of got that. But that's where we get into what does a coaching look like? What does parent education look like? It should all blend together, hopefully. All right, so if you'll see on the next page, we assess it with that assessment. We remediate, which means we try to change behaviors. We reassess again. Objective versus subjective, you know, and that's where I just gave the example of I'm really pushing my staff to do more and more object. We're supposed to do what's called process recording, like a police report, just the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Parenting, on the other hand, you can put an opinion in. So a lot of your centers, I know the visitations that you all have done, you may have a visitation center, your case managers may be doing it. Ideally, the visitation notes should just be very objective. Because many times, like you and your case managers and guardian ad litems, they want to just know what happened. They'll form their own opinions. They just want to know what happened. Because, frankly, you don't know the expertise. You don't know if this person says, well, the mother was mad at the baby. Well, how do we know the mother was mad at the baby? I mean, that's not going to – I love it when I talk to attorneys because you guys get it. I mean, they'll nail you about that in court. Okay. Most barriers that continue are substance use, ongoing mental health issues, and domestic violence. All right. If I'm a guardian ad litem, how do I know if they can really apply parenting? Okay, this is kind of just a guideline. Look at the pre and post assessment. Just because they've improved, I mean, that doesn't have to be the end all and the be all. I did forget this. A lot of you will see the AAPI, which is generated from Dr. Bavilek from the Nurturing Program. The AAPI is set up, the Adult Adolescent Parenting Inventory. It's kind of a self-reflection, and that's not a bad thing necessarily, but that should not be the only thing. Because if they have the impression, oh, yeah, I'm a good parent, I'm fine, well, that can be a grandiosity. And, I mean, I can't tell you the number of parents that say, well, I'm parenting the way my parent did, and I turned out just fine.
Mm.
You know, my kids are good. Well, sir, you may feel that way, but the dilemma is you can see what the judge is seeing when he looks at that shelter petition and the dependency petition. This is what it says. So you look at the subjective objective. What are the recommendations followed from parenting needs assessment, the parental fitness evaluation, the CBHA? Ideally, we take all those together, and I'm sure you all probably do that, because then it helps me in looking at it. Because I get, and now the FFA, I should have put that on there too. When we can get the FFA also, it gives us lots and lots of data to kind of put it all in context. Collaborate with service providers for consistency and recommendations. Now, so you'll be comforted, we don't always agree. I have one right now where I'm really thinking it would be okay for the 3 and 5-year-old who are severely delayed to visit with the parents that I've done. They're ready for it. The person did the PFE feels they are able to do it. But however, the child therapists are saying, we think this could, because this is a pretty severe neglect situation where they blacked out the windows and didn't feed them for a while. It was a really not good situation. But we're faced with the goal of reunification, so I don't have any choice about that. And under supervised visitation, therapeutic, I think it would be fine with the parents. But the therapist says not. And remember what I said, the developmental needs of the child. And that's what I told the parents. They're so upset about this. And I said, you know, I'm not saying the therapist is right or wrong. I'm just telling you, they're saying your sons have made a lot of progress in the last 6 months, and they're just right now not willing to risk that the trauma triggers. There we go, that trauma word again.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You observe the parent-child visits for prompted and unprompted progress. In other words, I will sometimes switch it up. And I'll say, I want someone else to do the visit. And like with you, guardian, sometimes it's helpful to have another person go in because you get a different perspective. Also, I hate to put it, how can I put this? I don't know that it's an intentional. But I got to know that they can do what I have taught them when I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be because, oh, I see Marty and I remember her talking about 1-2-3 magic. I've got to know that they can think to do 1-2-3 magic when Marty's not sitting there. And if I have another parent educator in there or a visitation monitor, then that's what we've got to see. And maybe in all honesty, there's some barriers that I have and they do better with someone else. So I like the idea that we look at it differently that way. Look at a pattern of behavior in visit notes. If you have a mother that just once or twice forgets to keep her baby strapped in the high chair, then it may be, you know, unfortunately we all as parents do things. But when we again and again and again, knowing that accidents are the leading cause of death of children under the age of 5, if the parent again and again doesn't observe child safety when they're told that,
mm-hmm.
That's a concern. Okay, now you see some pictures here. I just want to give you an idea of what best practice is, the least restrictive environment for children. Probably a lot of you on this call are parents. And of me, I have 3. And if I've engaged on my parenting, being in a room, especially with my 2 little boys who are ADHD, for an hour and a half, it would not have been a pretty sight. Okay? So I do think I want to be fair, and that's why we have to push sometimes. If you and I, in your communities, I don't know what you have, but doing a visit just in a conference room or even just one room is not a true measure of parenting. Logistics get in the way, and I'm just being honest here. You know, I will say sometimes, look, we got to get in the home. We have one right now, this one I was just talking about with the hearing problem. I'm pushing, we're going to have to circulate parent educators in there, but we need to have a good 6 hours straight supervised in that apartment. Because the dilemma is you have a new baby who just sleeps a lot right now. That's not telling me anything about how she handles things. But you see the pictures. This was actually taken around Halloween. We have 3 different kinds of playgrounds, a different age appropriate, and there again, that's a teaching moment. If a parent's not vigilant, even after we, it's not like we're trying to trap them. We talk this stuff. But they either A, don't pay attention, B, they get very defiant sometimes. Their need to be right, there again, that, and again, most of it's trauma triggering. They learn to, they want to push back before somebody gets too close.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, we try the best we can to build rapport, but at the end of the day, if they're not protecting their children, that's something we have to document. So you'll see we try to make it a happy place. We have, you know, this is Halloween. We have one of our parent educators, Miss Jane. Oh, she just loves, she's run a daycare center, and, like, she just decorates to the hill. So the happier and more friendly you can make it is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next few minutes, and then we'll have time for questions. Purpose of visitation. This, again, I gave you some sites that you, I really invite you to go to. Child Welfare Information Gateway, and they're usually at the summit every year. They have a booth. They are amazing in terms of the resources they have. But the primary purpose of visits is to meet the child's developmental and attachment needs. These are things you can use in court. I mean, this is ones I've used before, because when I get across you very talented attorneys who like to cross-examine me. I got to be on my A game and know what I back up when I'm talking about. Secondary purpose, when possible, is to teach parenting skills and then to evaluate the parent's ability to provide safe parenting. The goal, though, and this is something again and again and again we talk to parents about, is their child needs to feel safe and to hold the visits in the most natural and home-like location possible. So I have a list here of the next, a possible, and this is from the Child Welfare Information Gateway, settings you can do it. We've even done it, and I think Chris was involved, or maybe Kimber Strawbridge was involved with this case, where we, a few years ago, did not have the mother visit anymore. She was way too, she had murdered, she was way too emotionally unregulated. But I got my phone, and I would do videos, and we'd take videos back and forth. And she'd give a recipe, she'd send her child something about how to make hot chocolate like her mother used to make. And so we'd take it and I'd videotape the child's reaction. So there's a lot with our new, the way we have technology now, there are a lot of neat ways we can do visitation. We just got to make the effort to do it. And that goes to logistics. And this is where the guardians can be such an incredible influence because you guys can push it. You know, the judges may say, well, are there any things else we can do? There are a lot of other things it can do. The dilemma is my hands are tied many times. And if the case managers don't feel I had the resources to do it, they don't have the transporters, they don't have this, they don't have that, and frankly, they just don't take the initiative, it's real difficult. So these are a whole bunch of ways you can do types of visits. Visitation considerations. One thing I do want to make sure, if you look at the YouTube, that is an excellent series. It's just three easy ones to look at. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill put this together, and it's just a real good way to kind of understand the whole context and what parents go through. Can you imagine being judged and everybody micromanaging you? And as he says on this, can you imagine also 72 hours after the state has said you're not a competent parent, they throw you in a room with your children and say, parent. So it's a very traumatizing event for all concerned. And I'm sure I've lost sight of it at times. Let's talk real quickly about child reactions. The old days, many years ago, we used to shut visits off from parents if the children would get upset afterwards. The idea was, this has been luckily 30 years ago, that, oh my gosh, visits must not be good for children if they get upset. The reality is, and some of you may be in a situation like I was in with my first child, that there was a divorce. Saying goodbye is never easy. Traumatizing. So little children can't always express their words. And you add to that the triggers of trauma that the parents may represent and the mixed feelings, you're going to have that. And as one I talked to our clinical program director a few years ago, we had a two-year-old, the foster mother was just so frustrated because she would be acting out after every visit. And in our circuit, we have visits three times a week, which is best practice for little ones. So these poor foster parents are going through it. But as the clinical director said, the dilemma is you just got to help the foster parents through it. A two-year-old, there's no way you're going to totally get past that. It may come in time, but I can't promise you that. So this is pretty much what I had to offer. I hope it's been helpful. I know I talked fast.
Very nice.
With that. So if you have any questions, I'm glad to answer.
I do have one question.
Okay.
How can you tell the difference between the reactions caused by grief from the visitation and traumatic reactions based on just simply seeing the parent and having these traumas brought back up again?
Correct. And you know, the good news and the bad news there again is we don't always know. Now, what we're very, very lucky about here is and y'all all have therapists available to you. We have a trauma therapist built into, is a contract with FSS, actually, Family Support Services, where a trauma therapist, the children are screened for that. And even if after removal, because sometimes they're in shock, we begin in the visitation to see just what you're talking about. Number one, we will have what's called a therapeutic overlay for the visits. That way a therapist and a parent educator or a visitation person is there. And sometimes we do nothing but therapeutic visits. But in this case, we have that therapist there also for quite a few visits. And then they can work with the foster parent about it. And actually, it's really helpful because they also see these children separately. And they're able then to process what happened. Mm-hmm. So the dilemma is, and trust me, I mean, we had a really difficult case where, like I say, a sibling was murdered. The children were in the store when the child was kidnapped. They talk about trauma. It was awful. And I can't tell you how many court hearings we had about that. But luckily, we had a very, very competent trauma therapist who helped the children through it. In other words, we can't protect them from that totally. We can just emphasize we need to be safe. And I have to tell you, they started with us when they were like 4 and 5, and I'd say this took a long time to get permanency because it was such a high-profile case, it was international. But the little girl said to me at one point, we were trying to get the mom to do homework with her. And this is where we got with her. And that's why I'm saying, as much as it was hard on her, she was able through the treatment process to get some understanding. Because the mother was just not appropriate with homework. She just was not good with the daughter. So the daughter said, I don't want to be in here with this woman anymore. And I said, well, do you want Miss Marty to take you out and Miss Blair can stay with your sister? Yes. So we went in there, and she calmed down, and I said, okay, now I'm going to give you a choice. Do you want to go in there back with Mom, or do you want to go out? No, that woman, I don't want, why do you make me be with her? She can't do homework with me, Miss Marty. Don't you know she's crazy? Okay. Now, if we had not allowed that visitation, and it just said it's upsetting to her, and she's acting out in the foster home, her process, because a therapist does such an excellent job about what grown-ups' jobs are, is to keep children safe. Now, she loved her mother. She cried when termination happened. I mean, but she, at the time, had just turned 7. So what we do is we equip them in those early years to deal with that. That's kind of a long-winded response, I know. But it is, if it makes you feel any better, it's something we grapple with every day.
All right, anybody else have any additional questions for Marty?
Yeah, this is Jennifer from Fort Walton. I was really interested in some of the, you were talking about the dolls at the beginning,
yeah.
That would actually test kind of the parents' practical skills with an infant, because we're using early childhood court now. And a lot of times we don't have a good way to really assess that, but there's a push to move quickly towards reunification sometimes before we've really judged the parenting skills.
Yep.
What are there resources in different parts of the states? Is that something we would appeal to our CDC to work on? How would we get access to things like that?
Okay, that's a good question, and I highly encourage you to get it, because Family Support Services bought these years ago and loaned on a permanent loan to us to implement this. And you go to Real Care Baby, and Christine, and you have my email here. If you want to email me, I'll send you the link. But what's great about it, and one of the magistrates even said a few years ago to this lady, she maybe could have been a little kinder, but she said, how do you expect me to give you a real baby when you can't take care of a fake baby?
Mm-hmm.
This mother that I was talking about with a hearing problem, she has a reality baby when she was pregnant with the one she has now. She has 2 kids. She said, well, Johnny, I'll call him. He didn't cry like this. Well, yeah, you know, I'm thinking to myself, he probably did. That's why he was shaking.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't have a realistic view of it. And she was able to do fairly well with the reality baby, but she had to constantly be calling. We have 24-hour availability while they're doing the mannequins. And she just was panicked. So what that gave us invaluable data was she's got to have support. In other words, she can do it, but she's going to have somebody there that she can call or be right there with her and ask. So, yeah, the Real Care Baby, I think it's called, is where you would go. And I would go with your CBC.
How much?
They're pretty expensive. I think you can, I don't know, they're probably upwards of $1,000. I mean, they're not inexpensive, because this is pretty sophisticated. Does that help, I hope?
Yes, that does. Thank you.
And, you know, you bring up early childhood court, and it's real quick. This is the other dilemma we have, and we have early childhood court here, which is just wonderful. But if you don't, and I don't say this from the bias of being a parent educator, I believe you got to have good clinical work and you have to have pragmatic work. The therapists who are often trained in the CPP, they do the Kroll assessments, they do circle security, they do the whole thing. They're not always able to be as much in the pragmatic side, if that makes sense. We have one that did CPP with this little boy. Well, there's 2 other children behind. So they're able to say, well, yeah, the dad did pretty well in our office with the CPP. They showed bonding and attachment. Well, that's fine, but that doesn't help me when you're in Winn-Dixie and the kid's throwing a fit and they got 2 more siblings there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the parent education can give you a more pragmatic look, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blessing. We shouldn't have nothing but parent education. We need the clinical trauma piece too, but it should be a good blend.
Yeah. Anybody else out there have any additional questions for Marty?